You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
And it brought, critics say, catastrophic human consequences. Nearly 1.5 million people displaced to make way for the...
Entire valleys were flooded during construction. In total, 1.4 million people had to leave their lands and property to make way for the edifice.
To add to the distress, there are also huge environmental concerns. Even as it was being built, experts were already also warning of the ecological impact of the dam, the destruction of the ecosystem, the wiping out of entire animal species from the region, and the acceleration of natural disasters. Sad to say, they've been proved right.
Never wanting to let a good deed go unpunished, in the last episode, we problematised the erstwhile giant of the renewable energy sector. How clean is hydropower? What cost does it incur? It has been one of the most controversial forms of renewable energy out there because of these costs. In the past few years alone, popular protests against hydropower have arisen from Georgia to Brazil, Ethiopia to Sumatra, and that's despite all its potential advantages. As always, the tension is between those who would benefit from the energy and the impacts on those who do bear the costs. So, to the Mekong and to the Sambor Dam.
It's known as the mother of all rivers, helping riverine communities survive across many countries. The Mekong is a transboundary river, and without a doubt, Asia's most important waterway. It rises from the Tibetan glaciers in China. It then runs for more than 5,000 kilometers, cascading through Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, before emptying into the South China Sea.
The Mekong Delta and its bioregion provide the home, habitat, and resources for 70 million people, spanning six countries: China, Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Wild fisheries dot the Mekong and its tributaries. It is also one of the most productive and intensely cultivated agricultural areas in Asia. Almost 900 fish species inhabit the river, including 14 critically endangered ones, such as the Irrawaddy River dolphin.
The Mekong River is the most productive freshwater ecosystem in the world, gauged in terms of the fishery production. And the greatest productivity is in the very reach of the river where the Sambor Dam was proposed to be constructed. It's also, by the way, the Mekong, the second most biodiverse river in the world after the Amazon.
Gregory Thomas is the founder and CEO of the Natural Heritage Institute, an NGO dedicated to the mission of restoring and preserving natural functions in major river basins to maintain their water-dependent ecosystems.
So it's truly a global treasure, as well as exceedingly important for the livelihoods and well-being of the people that live along the river in the basin.
Here comes the hitch. Throughout the Mekong, there has been a spate of hydropower dam building by national governments, private investors, and construction companies.
A river that sustains some 60 million people is dying. The Mekong is one of the world's largest river systems, but man-made construction activity in the form of dams is slowly choking the river.
New hydropower dams on the Mekong River are causing problems.
The dam is changing the flow regime of the water. That is number one.
Leaving fishing communities high and dry.
Upstream dams, many built by China, have upended the natural cycles of the river, a waterway that feeds 60 million people.
Some 80 new dams are planned Thailand, in addition Cambodia, to the ones already Myanmar, existing.
Of these, many have been highly controversial and have triggered significant community opposition. Back in 2008, a feasibility study was put forward for a dam in the Kretier province, the Sambor Dam. This would be the largest dam proposed to be built in Cambodia.
To give you some idea of the scale of it, would have been a 2,600 megawatt hydropower dam, making it by far the largest of the proposed mainstream dam on the Mekong. So extremely large, in fact, hard to even envision. The width of the dam would have been 18 kilometers, which means, you know, something the nature of 11 miles. It would have taken you an entire day to walk fairly vigorously from one end of the dam to the other, if you can imagine. It would have been 33 meters high, but in many ways, the most important feature of the dam was the size of the reservoir it would have created. It would have backed up water some 82 kilometers along the river basin, all the way up almost to the border with Laos.
It came with an eye-watering potential price tag of $5 billion, which amounts to almost one quarter of the nation's GDP. The cost, of course, goes beyond the dollar value. The making of the reservoir would potentially displace upwards of 20,000 people, and it would have extensive impacts on the entire river delta and its species and the economies that rely upon them.
Well, the major concern was the impact on the fishery itself.
The Natural Heritage Institute, the NGO that Gregory directs, was commissioned by the Cambodian government to assess the costs and benefits of the Sambor Dam and its possible alternatives. This was a relatively unusual measure taken due to the simmering protests from this potential development. Villagers feared that their fisheries would be destroyed.
We calculated in our studies that had that Sambor Dam been built, it would have reduced fish productivity by 80%. It would have effectively killed the river.
The dam would destroy the fisheries because these fish species would be unable to produce and maintain their stocks.
Many of the most important of those species are long-range migratory species that need to move up and down the river corridor in order to complete their life cycle and reproduce and remain productive. The portion of the river corridor where Sambor would have been located experiences the greatest migration annually of biomass, fish biomass, of any place on the planet.
This isn't just a matter of a few fish in a river. These migratory fish make up the majority of the fish that account for more than 60% of the average Cambodian household's animal protein intake. That can't be easily replaced. It could threaten tens of millions of people who depend on these fish for sustenance and livelihoods.
The largest inland fisheries in the world, worth about $2.5 billion a year. But fisheries experts say plans by Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand to build hydropower dams on the Mekong would block fish migration, threatening already endangered species. Environmental activists say plans by Laos to build a dam in the Don Sahong area near the Cambodian border could doom the nearly extinct Irrawaddy dolphin.
The water flow and its sediments downstream. But 60 million people depend on the water and the nutrients of the Mekong directly for fishing and farming, like this fisherman in Nakhon Phanom in Thailand.
The water level is too low, and the climate is also changing. The water is lower than in other years. In the clear and shallow water, there are far fewer fish coming up the river. I only catch 60% of what I used to catch.
A second major concern was the effect on sediment flows into the Mekong Delta in Vietnam.
The riverbank used to provide farmland to the poorest Mekong villagers. Now water levels rise and fall without warning when the dams are closed to make electricity and the land yields little. Campaigners say fish species have been decimated, while the downstream is starved of vital sediment, sending a shock through the entire ecosystem. Locals fear a new $2 billion China-backed dam planned for Sanakam on the mainstream of the Mekong in Laos will be the end of the living
river. It might not sound critical, but sediment flow is key to both agriculture and fisheries.
The movement of sediment through this system is absolutely essential to maintenance of the exceptional biological habitats that account for the remarkable fishery production throughout the system. Sediment flows have already been substantially affected by the upstream dams that have been built in the headwaters in China, which removes about 50% of the sediment that would otherwise flow down through the Sombor site and into the delta. Now, where this impact is going to be felt is at the lower part of the system, in the delta itself in Vietnam, which is itself a remarkably productive ecosystem and food production system. In fact, half of the rice produced in Vietnam comes out of the delta, and Vietnam is now the second largest rice exporter in the world. So from a food production standpoint, extremely important, also great fishery production. This Sombor project would have trapped another half of the sediment flows after the half that's already taken out by China and would effectively doom the delta. It would disappear. 18 million people live there. And this would be one of the greatest ecological crises ever experienced on the planet.
The Mekong Delta isn't just a home to many people and plants and species, but also the agricultural and livestock powerhouse for the region.
The resource values are just off the charts in terms of importance.
So, given all of these things, why was the dam proposed in the first place? Well, it would have been productive in another sense. The dam was anticipated to generate 11,000 gigawatt hours of electricity every year. For perspective, Cambodia generated 7,000 gigawatts of electricity in 2017, which would mean a potential 160% increase. According to the United Nations, Sombor could potentially generate around three times Cambodia's current annual electricity consumption.
The conventional approach to hydropower dam development is to, first of all, select a dam site that has the potential to maximize hydropower production. The more the better. Hydropower dams are subject to very strong economies of scale. So the bigger it is, the more cost effective it is, essentially. So, first of all, design a project that will maximize power production, and then ask what the environmental impacts of that would be and what kind of mitigation strategies are feasible.
The problem with this conventional approach is that it only values one thing, the energy production, and fails to account for all the potential losses. It subordinates the project to energy production alone and none of the environmental impacts. Taking this approach, it is possible to build Cambodia's largest dam, and it would bring about a net benefit of almost $2 billion, according to one analysis. The Natural Heritage Institute took a different approach.
So what we did is just turn that on its head. We started by identifying the potential environmental impacts, given the characteristics of this fishery and the importance of maintaining the sediment processes. And then we developed environmental performance criteria to largely eliminate those impacts. And then optimize the design around that environmental performance, and then ask the question, with a environmentally optimal facility, how much power could be generated?
As always, what we measure is what we prioritize, kicking off by asking, how much would this cost the fisheries, rather than what is the maximum revenue that could be generated by the dam, completely changes the assessment. For one thing, the wider costs to the society are actually included. Secondly, it drove them to look at what an environmentally precautionary design would look like. The environmentally optimal facility had a range of never-before-seen design elements, hydrologic modeling to maintain the same river flow, moderating the water pressure by sinking the powerhouse 300 foot into the riverbed, redesigning the turbines to allow for maximal fish passage.
So with all of those features, we established a performance standard of 95% survival of fish through the reservoir, both upstream and downstream, fish and their larvae. 95% survival instead of 80% mortality. So a radical change in the environmental outcomes. We were very pleased with that design.
Of course, These features came at a price tag. This dam, which would protect the fisheries of the Mekong Delta and the people that relied on it, would generate far less power and cost far more to build. Plus, these were all designs. Nothing was guaranteed.
However, in the end, as we had to present to the government of Cambodia, we nonetheless advised the government that given the remarkable ecological importance of that reach of the river, it was still too risky to be approved. While all of our studies indicated we could achieve 95% survival of the fish, theoretically, in fact, many of these mitigation measures had never been instituted in the real world.
For such a complex ecosystem and such valuable fisheries, this would still be an enormous gamble. And given the dependence on this working out, that would make it a risky gamble indeed. The Mekong River Commission estimates that fisheries account for upwards of 18% of Cambodia's GDP, even more than rice production. A cornerstone of the kingdom's economy, fisheries directly employ almost 700,000 people, though the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization estimates that upwards of 2 million people derive their livelihoods from involvement in this sector.
We calculated that we would still lose between 13 and 30% of fish harvests in the downstream environment because of the need for these adult fish that are multi-year species to move up and down through this system several times. So even if only 5% are killed in each trip, the cumulative impact on mortality would still be substantial, maybe as high as 30%.
Balancing benefits from carbon reductions with damages to aquatic landscapes and fisheries, and with them livelihoods, the Natural Heritage Institute found that the kingdom faced a net loss of $740 million, a far cry from the projected figure of almost $2 billion. It is hard to quantify what that would mean in terms of an economic loss, harder still to quantify what that would mean in terms of increasing poverty, food insecurity, and cultural impacts.
Villagers are not getting any benefits from these dams. The only people that gain are the big business people involved.
Balancing the pros and cons of hydropower dams is the biggest challenge facing the Mekong Basin.
For Cambodia, it seemed that the benefits of the Sambor Dam didn't outweigh its costs. Well, what then to do?
What we looked at was foregoing Sambor entirely and instead looking at the alternative of augmenting, increasing the power generation out of existing reservoirs. And what we focused on was the largest new reservoir that Cambodia had just completed building called the Lower Sai Son 2. And the concept is simply to deploy photovoltaic solar panels at a large scale, the utility scale, on the reservoir surface itself and integrate the operations of both the solar and the hydropower facility as a single operating unit in a hybrid configuration. We were able to conclude that it would be possible to double the installed capacity, which would have provided an additional about 400 megawatts of power output with minimal impact on fish productivity and the natural environment.
This hybrid option, floating solar panels on top of a pre-existing reservoir, came out as superior to all the other options, including traditional power sources, in terms of reliability, stability of the power output, the cost, the timeline to get this energy online, and, of course, in regards to the damage to the local ecosystems. This has much wider implications for more flexible energy systems worldwide.
And the conclusion we draw from that is this concept of retrofitting existing hydropower facilities with solar panels with a view towards as much as doubling the installed capacity really is a winner. I mean, hydropower constitutes about 80% of the renewable power now being generated around the world. To decarbonize the power sector, it is going to be necessary to substitute coal-fired and oil-fired generation with these renewables at a very rapid pace for the 196 nations that are signatory to the Paris Climate Accords to achieve their pledges. The power sector will be one of the most important ones. It needs to be rapidly transformed.
What makes this possible is that these past few years have seen a dramatic reduction in the cost of solar photovoltaic power generation, known as solar PV. Nor is this proposal the only example of such hybrid systems. In the Qinghai province of China, 850 megawatts of PV panels were integrated into the 1,280 megawatt hydro project. So there is a precedent, and this comes at the perfect time. REN21, a policy network dedicated to sustainable and renewable energy, described the challenges and opportunities for the hydropower sector in their 2021 report. For the past few years, the ranks of aging hydropower facilities have been swelling. Back in 2019, more than half of all hydropower facilities globally either had already undergone or would soon require upgrades and modernization. As the technology improves and the thinking changes around integrating more variable sources of energy into hydropower facilities, these opportunities are expanding rapidly.
Have you ever heard of floating solar farms? In recent years, such structures have become more and more popular. And some experts even say that in the future, they will completely replace traditional solar panels.
Potentially capable of providing 50% of the world's ongoing energy needs, will also provide employment and nutritious food for locals. So what are the main benefits of floating solar? How is it likely to be rolled out worldwide?
And they're being installed on a reservoir in northeast Thailand. It's being called one of the biggest floating solar hybrid projects. It's under construction at a dam where workers are completing the last of seven solar farms covering over 100 hectares of water.
Moreover, looking back to the research from Dr. Oko in our last episode, the greenhouse gas emissions from hydropower facilities with reservoirs like the Sambor dams are unknown. In fact, a 2017 paper published in Environmental Letters attempted to assess the emissions produced by hydropower in the Mekong River Basin by looking at existing and planned reservoirs, and found, if tentatively, that hydropower in this region could not categorically be considered a low-emission energy source. There was considerable variation across the different hydropower projects, but they found that emissions could reach the emission levels from fossil fuel power plants, depending on the characteristics and location of the hydropower project. The Sambor Dam, with its low area-to-electricity ratio, large reservoir surface area, and high air temperature, was one with potentially large carbon dioxide equivalent fluctuations. That too wasn't included in their cost-benefit analyses, making these alternatives seem even more economical and appealing.
One fundamental piece of information is missing from the argument. It might sound counterintuitive at first, but hydropower is not emission-free. Around 10% of the world's hydropower facilities emit as many greenhouse gases as conventional fossil-fueled power plants. Some existing dams in the lowland Amazon have even been shown to be up to 10 times more carbon intensive than coal-fired power plants.
If you just look at the single-purpose hydropower facilities around the world, there are 6,102 of those now operating around the world. If all of those could be retrofitted with solar power, integrated hybrid fashion, the effect on carbon reduction around the world would be truly dramatic. And the fact that that can be done faster and cheaper with less investor risk than these other alternatives makes it a really attractive proposition. But time is of the essence. We need to move that agenda as rapidly as it's possible to do.
The example of the Sambor Dam, which did not in the end go ahead, teaches us much about the social risks of hydropower facilities. The destruction of both fisheries and agriculture, the impact on biodiversity and the mass displacement of peoples. The communities impacted by dam building were those most reliant on the river resource previously, the most damaged by its impacts, and the least likely to benefit from its resources. So where does that leave us? Do we throw out the baby with the bathwater and give up on renewable energy sources altogether, with their complex calculations and hidden costs? Well, let's not be too hasty. There are a myriad of other options out there, some of which we have already alluded to. The Natural Heritage Institute proposed the integration of floating solar PV inside hydropower facilities already in operation. Before that, Elissa Oko had mentioned another option, run-of-the-river hydropower. Let's spin back to Dr. Noah Kittner for an explanation of how that works.
The reservoir-based systems have a large impoundment and store and capture a lot of water, but the run-of-river plants differ because they allow for kind of the free flow of water and then usually have a turbine where they divert a little bit of water but maintain the flow of the river, and it spins a turbine to generate electricity and causes less river fragmentation. There still may be some ecological effects of the run-of-river hydropower projects, but generally many of the impacts are very site-specific. But without the reservoir, you're typically not really affecting the overall natural river flow.
This might sound hard to imagine, but if I can build a picture, large-scale hydropower usually requires a dam and a reservoir, which means flooding a valley so that the water can be released intermittently, generating on-demand kinetic energy. Run-of-the-river hydropower is built into a river with a pre-existing flow and derives its energy from that current rather than controlled release.
So there are some advantages to that type of hydropower. From an electricity generation perspective, it's a little more variable and intermittent, and so it's not as controllable or predictable. But the advantage with some of the run-of-river plants is that they could be paired with other complementary technologies. They could be used in a mini grid or a micro grid to provide some extra complementarity to solar or wind power, and emerged as an option that could be used in more remote areas or areas where you're not going to fully alter the river flow by building a large scale dam, but you could still extract electricity by spinning a turbine.
This could change our calculations around the costs and benefits of hydropower. Fewer emissions, fewer impacts on communities and ecosystems, but perhaps smaller scale.
There are some international institutions that do include larger scale hydropower as part of the decarbonization plan, but there are ways to produce clean electricity without some of those major trade-offs that we've seen or disastrous impacts of large scale hydropower. I actually think that there are some innovative forms of smaller scale hydropower that could do a lot less damage to the river ecosystems and also help meet some of the decarbonization challenges, is not to underestimate the climate crisis that we face globally. There are ways that these smaller scale hydropower plants could complement solar and wind scale up, and especially at kind of a distributed energy level. I think scale is definitely a big issue in terms of designing the decarbonized grid of the future.
This comes back to the idea that the Natural Heritage Institute was proposing through integrated systems. Over the past 5 years, the idea of hybrid renewable energy systems has become much more common by pairing much smaller energy systems with complementary technologies, like hydropower alongside solar, with backup fossil fuel generators in small mini-grids off the main system. There is extensive innovation in this space and in the small-scale hydropower space in general.
There's a company called Natel Energy that has a really innovative design. They're based in Alameda, California, and they can provide some other services like groundwater recharge in addition to generating electricity. And they're what's called low-head hydropower. So that's kind of an interesting design because it's accessible in many different places that might not have as steep of an elevation drop in water that you would traditionally associate with the potential energy needed to generate a lot of electricity. And so those types of designs are quite interesting and innovative, and I think have potential to provide cleaner electricity that also combines well with solar, wind, or other decarbonization goals and are less intrusive overall.
The major complaint with moving to small-scale hydropower is that it clearly wouldn't be able to generate the same amount of energy. Innovations like this one would drive up the amount of energy generated by small-scale hydropower, with the options of a flexible complementary grid system. There are thousands of different ways this could work, particularly well for small, remote, and marginalized communities in developing countries.
The solution, a solar-powered mini-grid. An affordable renewable alternative that can connect the homes and businesses in remote areas.
One of six hydrokinetic generators installed in Nepal by a Japanese company called Ebusse.
That provides solar energy in remote areas in Thailand who don't have access to grid power. I think the main benefit of renewable energy is that you don't have to have transmission line because you can create the energy from where you are. And also they live so far away in remote areas. Most of the time during rainy season, they will be cut off from outside world because you can
In fact, NOAA co-authored a paper published in February 2021, which looked at exactly that, how more strategic river basin planning could reduce the impacts of the dams in Myanmar. Reducing reliance on hydropower through scaling up these alternative energies allowed them to use river basin models more tactically to plan these dam portfolios to limit conflicts in planning across the basin and their overall impacts. Their most important conclusion was that Myanmar had the renewable energy resource potential to become energy independent and even a major exporter of low-carbon energy in Southeast Asia without sacrificing some of the last free-flowing rivers of Asia. Their goal? To highlight how it was possible to take emerging economies out of the dilemma of choosing among energy security, low-carbon footprints, and maintaining riparian livelihoods and ecosystems.
The primary alternative technologies that have emerged now include solar photovoltaics, so the cost of generating electricity from solar, especially in resource-rich areas like in Thailand and Laos, where you have a lot of incoming solar radiation, that has seen a lot of attention, and the cost has declined a lot for solar PV technologies in particular.
To really get a sense of how far solar has come, you need to look at it over the last sort of 10 years. In the early 2010s or so, solar electricity, it would cost you about $300 per megawatt hour. Today, you can get that electricity for around $30 a megawatt hour. And what has really driven that is a sort of fall in the cost of the solar panels. Manufacturing efficiency has steadily improved, as well as...
Now there are energy storage technologies like large batteries or also some types of retrofits to existing hydropower plants to be used as a pumped storage hydropower, where you could really just create like a closed loop hydro system and keep the water in an area and operate it sort of like a battery, where you could raise the reservoir height and lower it when you want to discharge electricity and move water up a reservoir when you have excess electricity. And so that could complement solar and wind well.
This has other advantages too. Small remote communities haven't historically been connected to national grids because the transmission lines alone could prove too expensive and technically challenging to put in. This would avert this problem altogether.
Traditionally, we've had a very centralized linear power grid where you have large-scale power plants transmitting electricity in one direction to over high voltages to an urban area, and then you would step down the voltage and distribute the power in a distribution network. But now there have been technologies that have allowed for things like microgrids or mini-grids, which could be a collection of a smaller scale larger grid and operate independently and flexibly from the main grid. And the places where this concept has emerged initially have been more isolated places like islands or mountainous regions that are really remote and expensive and difficult to build transmission lines.
These off-grid mini-grids are direct ways of tackling energy poverty in developing countries, putting energy systems directly in the hands of small communities. Each environment is different, with different strengths and challenges in terms of renewable energy technologies, opening a space for much more creative and flexible thinking.
However, as experience has grown with microgrids and mini-grids, I think that now there's a lot more experimentation going on, and especially in some places like in Thailand. So in Mae Hong Son, there's a smart grid pilot project for a microgrid that combines small-scale run-of-river hydropower with a solar farm and some utility scale battery storage and a diesel generator during some times when there's not enough other electricity to provide power for a remote mountainous region that is difficult to build transmission lines in and out. And I think that this idea has expanded not just to remote areas, but now to university campuses or places in urban areas that have a community wants to share a resource like solar.
These innovations aren't for developing countries alone.
What you're experiencing today is really the future of sustainability for remote river communities. And it's happening right here in Igiagig, Alaska. So I hope all of you...
We knew that we want to draw power from the river, but we absolutely cannot impact our fish, because that is our first and foremost mode of survival.
Community energy is when a group of people or a community of interest come together and they want to develop a renewable energy project, and they want to do that by involving the community, and they want to, you know, share the benefits with the community. It could be about a group developing a hydro project or a wind turbine or a solar farm or solar panels on a building.
Community Power is Ireland's first community-owned electricity supplier.
10 years ago, we created a renewable energy cooperative called EcoPower to help citizens create energy from the wind and sun.
Community solar is a model in which anyone who might consider putting solar on their roof, but is not able to do so for whatever purposes, signs up to receive a share of the electricity from a larger project.
Operating for a year through the summer and winter, and validating that we could generate meaningful amount of electricity and integrate it into the grid.
It's 24/7, 365, and it doesn't fluctuate.
So community energy is about participation, is about local engagement in our energy supply.
For me, fundamentally, it's more about people and doing and activism and taking back control than it is about
a lot of people have labeled us as a progressive community, but we operate from Indigenous values and we serve our people.
Rooftop solar has become increasingly popular globally, but as you may know, not every building is really suitable to put solar panels on the roof. There may be trees shade the building, or just there may be other shading issues that make it not so great, but you could still benefit from solar. Maybe you live in a region that's pretty sunny and your neighbors may have a pretty sunny roof. So why not try to share that electricity? Well, that's kind of part of the concept of a community-based microgrid, is that you could connect these houses or generation sources together that may be more locally generated and match the actual generation with the demand, kind of skip over the large transmission step. And now people are incorporating battery storage into these mini grids as well. And so you have independent systems that could be connected to a larger grid, or they could operate independently. And I think the flexibility is really the advantage of these systems, because they might not entirely operate off grid. That may be really expensive, but they may be able to benefit from a larger grid, but also have some more smaller components that provide resilience for outages. So historically, if there was a bad storm or an outage that would kind of shut down the entire grid, if people had more distributed mini grids, that may actually allow some communities to kind of retain power if there were a major storm. There have been advantages in the technology or advances in the cost of solar and storage that
this has additional advantages. Energy security, making communities and countries more resilient to shocks in their systems, whether natural or man-made. Ownership, giving power into the hands of the households using the energy, has been shown to decrease energy consumption overall, and in some areas of the developing world, increase the chances that they are able to maintain the upkeep of these smaller systems. Decentralized grids or community power isn't completely revolutionary. These systems have existed before, but might have been fossil fuels, such as diesel-based microgrids. These alternatives would be cleaner and perhaps more flexible, cheaper, and less polluting for these different populations.
And so it's really trying to meet local needs more clearly than a power plant that's built to export electricity over a long distance.
All that to say, this isn't the end of hydropower. However, as all of our guests have emphasized, hydropower as we have known it before isn't working in the ways that we need it to. For clean energy, for a just transition, for the protection of ecosystems already under threat.
I think that a lot of the plans for large-scale hydropower plants are misguided, and there are definitely alternatives to those technologies that could really benefit countries more locally. And I think this kind of resource dependence on extracting revenues from building large-scale hydropower and exporting power is not really a sustainable strategy for the long term.
Noah's argument is around the business model of these hydropower plants. Sure, likely these large-scale plants do generate more power than smaller mini-grid systems, however they are designed. But what is the intended purpose of all that extra energy? If you remember, the Sambor Dam could potentially have generated around 3 times Cambodia's current annual electricity consumption. The size of the dam cannot have been intended to supply the rural Cambodian population with electricity. As Cambodia has no national energy grid, it implies that all this considerable excess energy was earmarked for export to Vietnam or Thailand. Whilst it is important to develop natural resources for economic growth, and there's a chance that the revenues from these exports could have been reinvested into these communities, it isn't guaranteed. It seems even harder to justify for all the many costs outlined. Was the energy from Sambor even needed at all?
There are other ways to generate low-carbon electricity options where we don't need to force the resettlement of thousands of people and we don't need to harm the agricultural or fish or food dependence of millions of people that are relying on those natural systems. So I think that there are better ways to design a decarbonized grid. And hydropower could still play a role, but just the really large scale plants and greater than, you know, several megawatts are maybe just really too big and maybe not as necessary. And that may require some other changes in how we transmit and distribute electricity.
As always, this seems to make things harder, not easier. These proposals seem to suggest a fundamental rethink in the way we design our energy systems. Much like the previous questions we have considered, it means that simply shifting from one energy source to another, whether from coal to wind or oil to solar, isn't the whole answer. Much as in conversations around consumption of minerals for renewable energy technologies, these cases leave us asking, how much do we need the energy we produce? How can we change our energy systems from the bottom to ones which better serve all sections of society? When it comes to wicked problems, the challenges are almost too easy to identify. The solutions are much harder to find. But as these preceding episodes have highlighted, they are out there. Sometimes it is a question of finding them. Sometimes it's a question of convincing the necessary parties that they are worth the endeavor, and that the cost of ignoring them would be far more devastating. Sometimes the solution may remain a societal pipe dream. Many of the issues highlighted here, however, are eminently solvable, and it is for the public, our companies, and our governments to choose to do so, or bear the consequences. Many thanks to our interviewees, Gregory Thomas of the Natural Heritage Institute and Dr. Noah Kittner of the University of North Carolina. Kevin MacLeod composed the music, Cambodian Odyssey, and Nathan Moore composed the music for the season, The Future, Ancient Now. This episode was written and produced by me, Elizabeth Dykstra.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.